We'll talk about poetry in this time slot for the second day in a row, not because it's National Poetry Month, that's April, but because we're in the summer doldrums and a bunch of things are going sideways, and poetry is good for soothing the soul. So we welcome two Rogue Valley poets who are also major poetry boosters, Patty Wixon and Amy Miller. Patty Wixon has been writing poetry since she was 7 years old. She's published three other poetry collections just since 2010. Her latest is The Great Hunt and Other Poems. She has booked many literary guests on the Jefferson Exchange through Chautauqua Poets and Writers. Patty was once poetry editor of our members magazine, now called Jefferson Journal. Amy Miller holds that title now and is also a published poet, essayist, travel memoir writer, and more. Her works including The Trouble with New England Girls. And if you're wondering why Angela Decker is not doing this interview after talking with Maggie Smith yesterday, it's because Angela is in a writing group with our guests, so a little too much like interviewing family. Amy Miller, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
Patty Wixon, good to have you on the exchange again, too.
I'm really happy to have been invited.
So just general thoughts from both of you. Patty, does the world need poetry now more than ever?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that has shown that is the national response to the inaugural poet for President Biden's inauguration. And Amanda Gorman's poem that everybody seemed to be just so elated with. And she was even invited to perform at the halftime at the Rose Bowl. And so what could be bigger? No, it was the Super Bowl. Anyway, you know, the big sports event, and what could be better for poetry than that?
Yeah, when you got Amanda Gorman being asked to come to the Super Bowl, that is an indication that poetry is gaining a foothold in places where it didn't go before.
Exactly.
Amy Miller, what do you think? Poetry, the world need it more now than ever?
Oh, I certainly think so. You know, I go right to the pandemic and the isolation that everyone's feeling, everybody's staying home. It's been a remarkable thing in the poetry world that I've been involved with the past year and a half, and that's that, of course, all of the in-person events that we would normally do, readings, conferences in particular, even writing groups, couldn't happen for a long, long time. And, of course, like the rest of the world, the poetry world figured out Zoom really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Wish I bought stock in Zoom 2 years ago.
No kidding.
And so, you know, now we've got all these online readings and these Zoom readings and other video ways to get together. And now I can attend readings on the East Coast. I can attend readings in Japan. I can go to open mics where people are calling in from all around the world. And that did not happen 2 years ago. So I feel like, in a strange way, the poetry world has blown open. We are so much more connected now, and now we have this new technology that we will continue to use long after the emergency is over. I feel like we just got shoved into the future in poetry.
So daily practice has certainly had to change in how we connect to each other. What have you found, Amy, emerging in your work from this trying period in human history?
Oh, gosh. Well, I certainly wrote a lot about the pandemic early on because it was so strange. It was such a moment that we were going through, very surreal and sci-fi and dreamlike almost, and there was that fear. I felt like a documentarian. Like I needed to journal about it a lot, pretty much daily, and write poems about these strange moments just to have a record of it for myself, because I kind of felt like I wouldn't even believe these stories 20 years from now about how strange it was, and I really wanted to take a snapshot of that.
I'm sorry, I find myself laughing when I'm thinking about explaining this to kids and grandkids. It's like, wait a minute, toilet paper was not available because why?
Yes. That was your problem at the time? Well, yeah, it actually was. It was very strange.
Patty Wixon, how about you and writing with the pandemic?
Well, I think one of the things that was connected to what you said about Angela Decker and writing groups is that I think that there was so much isolation from each other that everyone was experiencing. Writing groups could still get together on Zoom, so we could still be hearing each other and encouraging each other. And And that was really marvelous to be able to continue that. Even though we weren't in person, we were still very connected. And I think that happened with a lot of people with book groups and things like that. And certainly, as Amy mentioned, a pandemic as a subject, I mean, it just seemed that everybody had something to write about and how what they were experiencing during the pandemic. And there was an extreme variety of views and experiences that often we never would have anticipated that other people would be experiencing.
A chance for people to really unearth some stuff that they didn't realize they were experiencing themselves and might not have if not for the pandemic.
That's right.
And Amy, I forget whether I saw it on Twitter or on a blog you had done, but there was a reference to writing in the pandemic at times being like trying to squeeze maple syrup out of an old bottle.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly after a certain time, I felt like in the first couple of months, I'd say I was on fire. Like I wrote about everything. I just felt like, you know, it was really, really fertile territory. And then it was similar to the smoke and fire, you know, that we've dealt with the past few years in the road in the Southern Oregon, where it just was so omnipresent that eventually it was too in my face. It was, I felt like I had to keep going and keep documenting it because the situation was changing. And yet it was kind of like trying to force down that 10th beer or something. It was like, I'm going to try this, but now I'm not enjoying anything about this anymore. And yet that's something to try to document. It was a real challenge.
Oh, so yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess you ended up documenting your inability to document things.
It's all part of the experience.
Wow.
Sure.
Yeah, that's one thing I've noticed in discussions with many writers is that you're very aware of things. You notice finer details in some cases than people who don't write do.
I think we're always thinking kind of like a painter. Ooh, you know, I could write about that later. Mm-hmm. I should note that. So yeah, we are certainly hyper aware of all those details, the visual details, and the conflicting emotions. That are happening. Those are really interesting to me. Like, oh, I'm feeling three different ways right now.
Yes, especially lately, I notice with it's like, hey, you know, we opened up for a month, and then the cases came roaring back.
Exactly,
and, yeah.
Exactly. And the fear of this isn't permanent, right? Like, this could all change in a moment because we found that everything changed so fast in the past. You kind of don't trust the good things.
Yeah, and maybe relish them a little more? Maybe we relish them a little more then, the good things?
Yes.
Savor those moments?
Right, the surprise, like just walking into a grocery store without a mask for the short time that we could do that. It was surreal and normal and joyful and a little fearful all at the same time. Like I can't believe I'm experiencing all these emotions at one time.
Right. I can feel air conditioning on my nose again. Yeah. Patty Wixon, we have a couple of poems set aside for that you had indicated you wanted to read. You want to do Cockroaches first or What Happened in Pullman?
Well, since Amy had requested that I read What Happened in Pullman, I'll start with that.
Okay.
And I will say that it's a narrative and that's one thing that a lot of people during the pandemic decided they were going to write a memoir, an autobiography of some sort, and they got a lot of pleasure out of that. And my autobiography events, I chose to do it in poetry. And so this first one is about an experience when I was 13. And and what I remembered so strongly from that situation is the sound of guns and what I was visually very conscious of all the time was the steep hill.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll begin. What happened in Pullman? We heard George's wife said, It was sunny, so we took a drive, and the kids had their Easter baskets, and we stopped for gas. And George went in to pay, and I heard crack. Knew he had his Luger from the war. He ran out yelling, "Get the kids out of the car," and I did. He took off fast, and crack, shot a cop coming across the street. We heard Jim Roberts tell everyone that started in this dairy on Palouse Highway, where George went berserk. He tried to talk him down, but George shot him, crack, in the leg. "If you don't want to get shot again, get out of here." And when a cop came, George shot him, crack, in the chest. The dispatcher heard that George was headed to campus, sent officers up campus at College Hill. They radioed back, "We're on Howard Street, pulling into the alley, thinking he'll head down the hill." Our family was having a backyard picnic when we heard a car screech into the alley, saw cops running to the hill, and fire two shots, crack, crack, close by. We left our lunch, ran down our stone stairs across the alley, and followed the cops down the hill. One turned and yelled, "You kids get out of here, now." We backed up the hill, sat down to watch. We saw George hide behind a blackberry tangle, saw a taxi stop at the dead end. The driver got out in his blue suit, looking like a cop, and crack, George shot him. Then crept from behind blackberries, ran down the hill, not stopping until he got behind the warehouse. More cops, crack, 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 George picked off three. Then crack, 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 and George fell dead. We heard George's death certificate said self-inflicted, but guess they didn't count all the bullet holes. We told George's wife and kids left town, and Jim Roberts sold his dairy, became postmaster, where he could sit at a desk and rest his leg.
The poem is called What Happened in Pullman, read by the poet Patricia Wixon here on the Jefferson Exchange, part of her recent collection, The Great Hunt and Other Poems. We also have Amy Miller with us on the Jefferson Exchange, also a published poet and author. And you're welcome to join our conversation about poetry and writing about the world around us at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, George, I lost track of the number of police he shot. This is a shocking story for any time, and you were there.
Yes, and of course, you know, a 13-year-old, it was a whole lot different from what it was from other people, and I thought of that. Thought that through the years, and occasionally my brother or sister would mention it. But then there was one of my brothers discovered an article in the Pullman Herald newspaper there, weekly newspaper, and the stories it told were different from what we had remembered and what other people said. So it was. Like Amy says, there was many different emotions from many different people, and so that was just, it was just, I enjoyed putting it together into one poem.
You emphasize the word crack well. I should point out for the people who don't have the written text in front of them as I do that crack is always capitalized. It's all in caps, so it's the crack of the guns is a constant theme in What Happened in Pullman by Patty Wixon. Do you, Amy Miller, have a poem at your elbow you'd like to read?
Sure. Well, since we're talking about the pandemic poems, I'll read one from that experience. You know, this is kind of early in the pandemic when so many of us were learning how to make masks.
Mm-hmm.
I had a New York Times article, which was the sort of the pattern that I used for several masks. That was my favorite one. It was, and I hadn't sewn in probably 30 years, something like that. So I got out my mom's old sewing machine, and it was, you know, it was interesting how you would find the fabric, you know, to use for these masks. So that's what this is about. This is called Pandemic Day 40, Repurpose Old Shirts for Masks. I expected regret, but not this dissection. How clever the sleeves, each a single sheet, shoulder shirred, shape tapered. Such skill in the bound-off seams, square cuffs. I cut it all away, lay each part flat on the table. I keep thinking of charts, loin, shank, ribeye, chuck, the countries of a body. The back, for instance, perfect for the long ties, strips, plaid lines to guide the shears as it gives up all that held it together, making an almost beautiful sound, like someone who worked all day and is now changing into something else.
And that was Pandemic Day 40?
Right.
Right, by Amy Miller. I love the descriptions of the loin, shank, and ribeye, the countries of a body. It is kind of like a map when you look at the thing on the wall.
Taking apart your own clothing to mm-hmm. repurpose it into something else was a chance to really examine the clothing and how it was made, which I had really never looked at. And it really was like sort of using an animal for some other purpose than being an animal.
So did you count by fives, or is there a pandemic day 39 and 41? I mean, I'm just curious to know what your...
They're all over the place. You know, I didn't write one every day. So I have quite a few from early days and then a few from kind of the 167 to 190 something range. And I've got something, a few in the 300 range. And it's very interesting to see the different things that I was noticing and that we were doing. Like I've got one from, probably day 300 something that's about my neighbors here who would gather on someone's front lawn. They would socially distance in their lawn chairs. And they had been doing this a couple of times a week for several months. And I work at home, so I couldn't go out and join them because I was working, but I could hear them out the window. And it started out as kind of a coffee thing. And then I was driving by them one day, and they all had wine glasses. And I said, hey, I said something about you changed your day, and they all held up their wine glasses, and they said, it's every day now. They're out there having this party on the street. So we were way into it by that time. So that was very different from the first, 100 days or so when the fear had morphed into something else.
All right. So, yeah, so something more like resignation or acceptance, I guess.
And almost joyful gathering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Patty Wixon, I want to talk about the work that you and husband Vince have done over several decades in promoting poetry in Oregon. It's one of those things where you look at the list and it unfolds like two or three times. You've done amazing things in trying to make sure that poetry is available to anybody who wants it.
Well, poetry, and we interspersed it a little bit with fiction writers, but it was a wonderful opportunity. For us, as well as we knew that how much students would be getting out of the writers that came in and poets, and it was there was a strong attempt to have poetry be a normal, inclusive part of the curriculum in schools, and that was one of the goals in bringing these writers in, because these were famous poets that would come to classes. Vince would take them to his English class at high school, and the kids would just hear this really, really fantastic work and meet the poet. And there are a lot of people that were very much influenced like that. For instance, Nathan Harris, author of The Sweetness of Water, who, when he was at Ashland High School, joined as a high school student in our Chautauqua Poets and Writers Board. And he went on he just had his first novel published that Oprah recommended, mm-hmm. and also Obama included him on his summer list of the best reads for the last year. And so it doesn't get any better than that. And so it feels really good to think that that bringing those riders to the high schools in the area really influenced people's lives.
And you you often brought them to the Exchange Studio, too, for which we are eternally grateful, because it was always fun to talk to the authors on the way to their events.
Well, that was always the first commitment. We made a list of what the writer would need to do, and that would be the first commitment. And if the person wasn't willing to have to be interviewed by you, and we knew it was going to be a terrific interview, and if they weren't willing to do it, then they weren't invited to come.
Wow. I didn't realize we were part of the standard set for the writers. That's
good to
know.
Absolutely.
Amy, I wanted to ask you about the Oregon Literary Fellowship you got awarded in what, April of this year?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something I had been trying for many years. You know, it's open to writers who live in Oregon. Usually they hand out two, maybe three for poetry per year, and they get applicants from all over the state. It's free to apply. So it's basically money. You know, they send you a check. The award this year was $3,500, which is a great payday for a poet. And it's Patty laughs knowingly. And they ask that you spend it toward working on a project, researching, traveling, completing a book or whatever writing project you're working on at the time. So I'm still trying to figure out, you know, all the ways to spend that money, especially not being able to travel.
Yes.
So I'm doing a lot of Zoom workshops, taking more Zoom online classes than I ever have before, like things that I would look at and say, oh, that would be nice normally, but I wouldn't spring for. And now it's like I'm playing with house money, you know, so I can do a few more things. I'm buying a lot more books, a lot more poetry books than I normally do. I'm going to be teaching a class at the Jacksonville Library in September, which is on publishing your poetry. I call it publishing your poetry in today's literary landscape. So a lot of it's about publishing online and, you know, where to find publishers. And I'll be buying some door prizes to give away. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a great thing to do with the fellowship money, you know, to buy some things for the people who attend. It's been a huge intake of gas into my poetry tank.
Huh.
You know, it was a great feeling of validation that felt very immediate, like right away. It made a difference in my confidence in my own work, in my desire to write more and to be more kind of present in the poetry world. Yeah, it was a great shot in the arm. Pardon the pandemic pun.
Right. Before we go, we just have a little less than a minute to go here, and I just wanted to ask each of you. You provided lists of us for us of summer reading. I guess we can get basically your the top of your list, each of you, before we go. And so, Amy, what's the top of your list for poetry books or summer reading?
The one that I love the most is called Obit, O-B-I-T, by Victoria Chang from Copper Canyon Press.
And I'll add to that Anis Mojgani, the Oregon Poet Laureate, who joined us when he was early in his term. So
yes, go on YouTube and find his poems.
And then Patty Wixon, top of your list for recommendations for summer poetry reading? Or just
well, I think that new books by local authors always enjoy picking up alongside books by poets who've known for several years. But that would be... Daybreak on the Water by Gary Lark.
Uh-huh. And he's been an Exchange guest, too. All right.
By Kim Stafford.
All right. Great suggestions. Patty Wixon and Amy Miller, thank you both for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.